listening to Avasant on the Record, a podcast discussing key trends and insights into government-driven markets.
With Avasant on the Record podcast, I'm August Cole, writer-in-residence. I'm joined today by Matt Vallone, Director of Research and Analysis, and Doug Berenson, Managing Director at Avasant. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
So, Doug, I'll start with you and ask a question really about the surprise that this presidential election delivered. A Trump victory, however, has raised probably more questions than it's offered answers about U.S. defense priorities, particularly in Europe. So just what is the outlook now? And when you think about when we might see concrete indications of the next administration's priorities?
I'll speak to the surprise issue first. I think that it's clear that there is broad surprise. I think it was notable that President-elect Trump apparently was on the phone with the South Korean president yesterday, reassuring her of the steadfast relationship between the two countries and the need to deter North Korea, because it was clear during the campaign that he was willing to put our allies in a somewhat uncomfortable position about increased burden sharing and questioning the durability of the commitment unless certain financial commitments were made. I'll be curious to see whether President-elect Trump makes some similar phone calls to our allies in Europe this week. I think that could probably go a certain distance to reassuring people. I think Europeans probably have to be thinking really hard at this point about what their own long-term security arrangements require in terms of funding and in terms of a closer European military association. In terms of priorities, Trump's made that pretty clear, actually. Both in terms of a speech he gave in September, where he laid out a series of national security and defense priorities, and in a 100 days agenda memo that his team released yesterday. There's a series of priorities, including on defense and national security, that are reasonably clear cut. It's significantly more money for the Department of Defense, and a few specific priorities underneath that level. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of mystery about what direction they're likely to take. The question is, how quickly some of this unfolds, and what other events intervene to interrupt their progress.
So, Matt, let's turn to the Senate and the House election results. There also was a fair bit of surprise there, and obviously with a lot of impact. So give us a readout and tell us about what we should expect with the Republican House and Senate.
So, yeah, I mean, I think it's a little bit surprising just in the sense of how few seats Democrats picked up. And the Senate's going to look at basically 52-48 once you get the Louisiana runoff out of the way in December. And the Democrats only picked up five seats in the House, leaving the Republicans with a 241 to 193 majority. Excuse me, 242, excuse me. So I wouldn't expect too much different than what we saw in terms of leadership packages and committee chairmanships. There are a handful of exceptions, but who's in charge will look a lot similar to who's in charge in the 114th Congress. You'll still have some tensions in sort of the Republican caucus that will be where any sort of holdup in the budget process might arise. As Doug mentioned, the tensions between sort of defense hawks and budget hawks will be something to watch. But overall, the majorities are, I think, stronger than people would have expected heading into election night.
When you look at the victory, and of course, during the opening months of a new administration, there's a lot of unity in a party, particularly, I think we'll see that with Republicans. But once we really start to get down to the nitty-gritty of figuring out how to put a lot of the Trump administration's plans into action, what sort of friction do you see emerging within the Republican Party? Issues like Iran, even non-defense issues that are relevant, like infrastructure. I mean, some of the 100-day plan pushback, focused on that, for example. Doug, so talk a bit about how you read that.
Yeah, so I think it's clear that there's probably greater consensus on the core defense issues than on a lot of other areas. But even in defense, I think there's going to be some room for disagreement as these two sides sort of feel each other out, the Trump White House and the GOP Congress. You mentioned the infrastructure spending. The 100 days plan that was issued yesterday, the day after Election Day, talked in terms of public-private partnerships, which I think is sort of notable because it indicates a recognition perhaps that the Congress does not want to provide a lot of pure federal money for these kinds of activities. A couple of other areas outside of defense as well, where I think we're going to see some real disagreement between a Trump White House and the GOP Congress. Within defense itself, I can think of a couple of areas where they're really going to have to either come to some clear agreement or agree to disagree. I'd list a few of those. One is, look, how much deficit spending are we going to allow here? GOP budget hawks, have really controlled the agenda for the last 5 years. It's essentially what gave us the Budget Control Act and kept it in force. And while I think there's complete consensus in the GOP caucus about the need for higher defense spending, how much more defense spending could really get modulated to some degree by the need to contain the scale of the budget deficit over time in an environment of tax cuts and other things? Another policy to think about here is, some of the policy changes that the Department of Defense always wants, no matter who the president is, but that the Congress is always very reluctant to give on, no matter who the president is. And I'll list two of those. One is another round of base closures. The department is, I think, fairly unanimous in the notion that there's about 20% too much base infrastructure being carried in the budget than the department really needs. There's a better prospect, I think, of getting a BRAC round approved when the president and the Congress are of the same party than there has been during the Obama administration, where that proposal went precisely nowhere. But even still, even with a Trump administration, I think a GOP Congress is probably not going to be real enthusiastic about another BRAC round, no matter how hard the Pentagon asks. Similarly, on the personnel compensation side, the Obama administration has put forward a series of reform measures to change how servicemen health care is financed. It's always been a little bit more conservative on the pay increase side than the Congress has wanted. And part of me thinks that the Congress is going to continue to act like the Congress, no matter who is doing the asking on some of these reform proposals. And all of these have long-term budget implications for the department that are not good. But I just think the Congress is at a place that even a president of their own party can't move them from. And then lastly, where I think we really don't know where the unity is or isn't, is on Iran. I think that there's been pretty clear consensus in the GOP caucus that the Iran deal, the Iran nuclear deal negotiated by the Obama administration with some other countries, needs to be abrogated. They want to rip up that deal and get rid of it entirely. I think Trump has been a little bit cagey on the campaign trail about exactly what his stance is on that. I don't think he's in favor of the deal. I don't think he would ever express that. But if you assume that tearing up the deal has the potential to put us on a war footing with Iran, I could see the new occupant of the White House not wanting to go down that path, at least not right away. So it will be very curious to see, in the next 6 weeks, whether the Congress lets him play this as he wants to play it, or whether they really agitate for action on the Iran deal.
Do you, either of you, foresee any division on the issue of how to engage with Russia? Because clearly there is an interest on the part of the next administration to do that.
Well, it's clear. I think there's huge division on that point. You could see that in the presidential debates that took place this fall, where now Vice President-elect Mike Pence, was clearly on the record taking a far more aggressive stance vis-a-vis Russia than candidate Trump did. We're going to have to see how that plays out. I think that this is clearly a fairly heartfelt point of view by Donald Trump. And I don't know, there are going to be a lot of areas in defense policy where President Trump is going to fundamentally defer to the people around him, because he doesn't have the kind of knowledge or the kind of passion about the issue enough to really get closely involved. And I think he'll really be deferential to the people he surrounds himself with. But this doesn't strike me as one of those issues. You know, this, you know, the question of our relations with Russia seems to be something that he has thought about very carefully. You know, in his desire to have a friendlier relationship with Russia, I don't see him giving up on that. You know, and I think that he's really going to have to find some common ground with the congressional leadership and his own vice president on how to play this. And I could see the conflict in Syria and against ISIS maybe being a crucible for that. The president-elect, you know, has talked about coming up with a plan to defeat ISIS within 30 days, or developing a plan within 30 days to defeat ISIS. And you have to assume that a plan like that has to involve some sort of relationship with Russia, whose forces are already engaged in that part of the world. I think that is going to be the sphere in which this question of how do we relate to Russia is going to start playing out.
You know, Matt, how do you kind of read that issue of kind of the political positions that will have to be staked out within the Republican Party?
So I think that, you know, it sort of now remains to be seen, because there clearly is tension there. But my sort of initial impression would be that after sort of Trump has sort of given Republicans unified control of the government and has won the White House for the first time in two terms, congressional Republicans might be inclined to sort of let that issue lie absent some type of provocative action or provocation from Russia. So unless there's sort of further incidents in Ukraine or some escalation there, you might just see sort of silence on their front and some space for Trump to work with Russia in Syria, again, absent some type of intervention that requires a response.
You know, back in March, War on the Rocks published a letter signed by 122 of the leading Republican voices in national security, essentially saying they opposed a Trump presidency. And so that leads me to wonder and to participate in the, I suppose, you know, parlor game of the moment in D.C. Who is going to be the next Secretary of Defense, you know, Secretary of State, National Security Advisor? What kind of you know, indications are out there right now?
So a lot of names are floating around. Most of the names are the people who have been associated with the Trump campaign as surrogates or advisors for many months now. I think the name on everybody's lips as far as Secretary of Defense right now would be Senator Jeff Sessions, Republican from Alabama, who has been on the Trump team before a lot of other people were comfortable announcing in support of Trump. That's not been formally announced, but the way transitions work, it's very likely that we're going to see the names of cabinet officers, proposed cabinet officers, and cabinet level people largely all announced by Christmas. You know, other names that people are talking about, Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, seems to be in contention to be the next Secretary of State. Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani, another close Trump associate, seems to be in the running for Attorney General, although I've read in a few places that he also has had his eye on the Secretary of State post. You know, we'll have to see how that goes. A lot of people are familiar with some of the defense people who have been around Trump for many months now as key advisors. A couple of those are general officers, or retired general officers, I should say. One thing to point out is that there is a law that says that a general officer has to wait, I think it's 7 years, from his or her separation from the service before taking at least the Secretary of Defense post and possibly other very senior civilian posts. So some of those individuals may continue to advise Trump, but they may not necessarily be a lock on the SecDef role in a way that people think. There's another retired general, three-star named Keith Kellogg, who is very active on the Trump transition team right now in planning the transition in the Department of Defense, identifying senior appointees, planning budgetary transitions and things of that nature. He's going to be immensely influential for that reason alone, even if he doesn't actually take a position in a Trump administration. You know, August, to your question about that letter, you know, the letter signed by, you know, some GOP luminaries, you know, I'd say two other things about that letter. One is about the names that were not on that letter. And, you know, I think for a number of weeks now, people have observed that a gentleman named Steve Hadley did not sign that letter. You may remember that Stephen Hadley was a national security advisor to President George W. Bush. And I think a lot of people have assumed that he might be a way of choosing a senior advisor for President Trump who could serve as a bridge to the GOP national security establishment at a time when so many other of those individuals have essentially sort of taken themselves out of the running. And then there's the question of the people who signed the letter to begin with. We saw a lot of members of Congress, at least these last several months, unendorse Trump and then endorse Trump and then, you know, waffle back and forth. Now that he's won and that he is going to be reshaping the government and the agenda in his image, it would not even surprise me a little bit to see some of those people come out over time and say, you know what, I've given it some thought, and I think this is maybe an administration I really can work with. So we'll have to see how that plays out.
You know, Matt, weigh in a little bit on that, especially the idea of having a lawmaker become the Secretary of Defense.
So, I mean, I think that, you know, the names that Doug listed are pretty reasonable. Senator Sessions has been around for a while and does have a decent defense background. But we've also heard names like former Senator Jim Talent mentioned for that position, former General Mike Flynn, even possibly Duncan Hunter. But so we'll have to see. I think Sessions clearly is the favorite at this point for the role, which might help in terms of sort of the budgeting process. But so we'll have to wait and see on that. The only other thing I would say is in terms of the requirements on generals limiting their ability to serve after they've left the service. Apologies for the poor phrasing. But there are waivers available underneath that law, so it wouldn't shock me to see that used to allow Trump's picks to move forward.
You know, shifting gears to the defense industry implications here, you know, one of the things that seems worth asking is, considering that international customers and partnerships are so important, particularly with NATO nations or treaty allies like Japan, as with the F-35, how does this play out for the department and for industry when, you know, many of these status quo assumptions about our relationship to NATO, also our Pacific alliances, seem to have a lot more uncertainty with them? I mean, it seems like there's both a business but also a strategic implication.
Yeah, I think that the first thing we need to do really is figure out where this administration is going to end up in terms of various bilateral relationships. You know, a lot of the statements made on the campaign trail and people's reading into some of those statements would suggest, you know, some really severe discomfort by a lot of allies about U.S. commitment to them. So I think that that President-elect Trump and the people around him are going to have a chore over the next several weeks and months to clearly communicate what are their expectations with respect to U.S. relationships with South Korea and Japan and NATO states and so forth, Canada. Until we see that shake out and to see President-elect Trump speak as President Trump on these issues and make clear what he's really going to ask for and the attitudes that he really will bring to these relationships, we can't really know. But to be clear, I think if the United States really does try to drive a much harder bargain with our allies in terms of burden sharing, you know, the public shaming associated with not getting, you know, NATO allies not spending 2% of GDP on defense and so forth, then I think you could see a real lack of comfort in terms of engaging in bilateral or multilateral defense equipment development and procurement arrangements. You know, I think some of these programs are mature enough at this point where it's not practical, I think, to turn them off. You know, so I'd raise F-35 as an example here. I think there are so many nations so committed to F-35, have been planning on it, you know, for so long now that it's really in the implementation phase now. And I think that I really would not expect that to be fundamentally upset as a result of a change in U.S. administration. But from here on out, on, you know, sort of potential new arrangements, you know, new international sales, new proposals for co-development of of advanced defense systems. Look, the fact is that the rest of the world, the non-U.S. portion of the global defense supply chain, is increasingly capable. And I think that if you consider that countries buy complex weapons and military equipment, not just to satisfy military requirements, but also to strike political relationships, if the value of those political relationships is seen as less than it once was, countries will go to other sources. They'll go to China. They'll go to Europe. They'll go to Israel and Turkey and South Korea and Brazil and these other places who increasingly have very capable systems to sell.
The only thing I also would add would be, you know, we have to kind of wait and see what Trump ends up doing on trade, because I feel like there's not a small possibility that some future activity could be negatively impacted by, you know, Trump's decisions on things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership or NAFTA or future trade deals with Europe. If that becomes a scenario where you see tariffs rising and trade barriers being put in place, that may bleed over into military sales as well.
Yeah, no, I think that's a great point. I think there are a set of issues about which President-elect Trump clearly cares deeply. And then there are a lot of others where I think those are not of high priority to him. And it's clear that trade is, you know, in the top three in his mind. And he's going to drive some of these some of these bilateral relationships in that vein. You know, we're going to go into what I assume is going to be a very difficult set of conversations with Mexico. President-elect Trump wants to have China declared as a currency manipulator. So U.S. relationships in some parts of the world clearly will be driven mainly by these trade relationships, and bilateral relationships on military cooperation and defense equipment sales will take a back seat to those priorities.
You know, at another kind of higher level, in terms of rising U.S. defense spending being part of the Trump administration platform, that begs the question of spending on what? And then also, does that have any interface with the desire to create more jobs, you know, manufacturing, particularly throughout the U.S.? You know, does defense become part of the jobs play for next administration?
I think that's possible. In terms of what the Trump administration would spend new money on, many listeners probably know that Trump gave a speech in September outlining a reasonably detailed defense plan, building on some thinking that the Heritage Foundation had done. And that called for essentially a return to the defense budget top line, the base budget top line, that we saw in the FY 2012 president's budget, back when Robert Gates was the Secretary of Defense. A defense top line on that scale would be between 17 and 19% higher than the 2017 budget, president's budget, that the Congress has had in front of it for some time now. The question is, what would you buy with that? In September, candidate Trump pointed to all manner of forces that would increase in size on the strength of that budget increase, you know, a significant increase in the size of the Army and the Marine Corps and the Navy and the Air Force. So it's a little vague on the Air Force, actually. You know, I think that the primary claimant on this new money will come probably in two areas. The first is shipbuilding. You know, there's a fair bit of risk in the shipbuilding program, principally presented by the what's now called the Columbia class nuclear ballistic missile submarine. We used to call it the Ohio class replacement program. That program is of extreme priority because it absolutely has to be in operational service by 2027 under the terms of U.S. nuclear posture policy. But it's also going to be expensive enough that I think the Navy doesn't. By general consensus, the Navy has not budgeted sufficient money to make that happen. You know, this is going to be a very complex and expensive undertaking. And I think the first place where new money will go is probably to that program and to shipbuilding more broadly. Trump talked about getting to a 346 ship Navy. Some listeners may know there are several Navy force structure reviews currently ongoing, both within the Navy itself and in some other groups around town here. And a fleet size objective of 346 ships, I think, is almost sort of becoming the consensus opinion on where the Navy should strive to go. Now, getting a fleet of 346 ships would require a substantial increase in the build rate of surface combatants and submarines and the future frigate and other vessels. And once you try and achieve that, there may not be a ton of this new money left over to do other things. However, the second area where I think you could see some of this new money go is the size of the Army. The U.S. Army has been in a difficult conversation at best with the Office of the Secretary of Defense about what the size of the active force should be. I think some people in the Office of Secretary of Defense have talked about numbers as low as 420,000 active soldiers. The Army leadership looks at that as utterly unacceptable. And I think would probably prefer something around the level of 490,000 active soldiers is really the floor. In fact, they'd like something north of that, actually. I don't know where the Army will end up in terms of active end strength, but wherever it goes, that's a very expensive bill over time. And once you pay that bill, once you commit to paying that bill, not clear how much excess new money there will be to do a lot of other high-end defense investment. I'm sure that a lot of programs may get a little bit healthier in terms of buying down risk with a perhaps a somewhat more comfortable budget. But I would not expect a lot more new START programs to emerge out of this. I think you would need either a fundamental rethinking of our strategy, which I suspect is not in the cards, or you just need a lot more money than I think, at least, is likely to be made available.
Well, Matt and Doug, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
Happy to be here.
With Avascent's On the Record podcast, I'm August Cole.
You've been listening to Avascent On the Record. To learn more about Avascent, go to avascent.com or follow us on Twitter at @avascent.